Notice anything different about the music this week, Dominic?
There was no sheep.
No sheep. That is the original, much more lo-fi version of our jingle, made by our beloved composer Jim Barn, that aired for the first time 5 years ago this week. Pretty crazy.
That is amazing. Yes, because drum roll, please, everyone. This is our fifth birthday. Happy birthday to us.
Yay! Yay!
So you'll hear from those rapturous yays that we are marking the occasion with a little party. It's not just me and Katie this week.
It isn't, no. We are joined by producers Kat Laszlo in Amsterdam.
Hello.
And Wojciech Oleksiak in, well, usually you're in Warsaw, but today you're in Cyprus, right?
Yeah, I'm in Limassol.
The things you get to do working for the Europeans.
That's true.
So we wanted to do something a bit special to celebrate the half decade in which we've been making this podcast. It's been quite a wild ride. There have been highs.
This is something that RuPaul does in RuPaul's Drag Race. It's probably the first time RuPaul's Drag Race has been mentioned in the European Parliament. And he... Yeah?
There have also been lows. You know that lovely prize that we won a couple of years ago? The Spinelli Prize.
Yeah.
And they gave us that big certificate in a frame.
Yeah.
There's no easy way to tell you this, but it's covered in human excrement.
Why? Oh, God.
How did that happen? I have forgotten the backstory.
There was a leak in my basement and our certificate got covered in human shit. It was a great moment.
It's a great way to do a little humble brag there, Katie. Reminding everyone that we won an award. Anyway, we thought we'd take this momentous occasion today as a chance to look back at the past 5 years. When we started it, Angela Merkel was still in power. None of us had heard of a thing called COVID-19. And Katie and I had yet to become fully fledged Eurovision nerds. All of that has changed.
All of that has changed. And actually, I wanted to start by playing you the literal moment that this podcast was born. Because luckily for us, this historic moment was actually recorded. The Europeans began its life in early 2017 with a long exchange of WhatsApp voice memos between Dominic and me. We were long distance friends living between Paris and Amsterdam. And we would talk a lot about podcasts in general and Europe in general. And then eventually I plucked up the courage to ask Dominic something that I had been wanting to ask him for a while, which was, would you like to start a podcast with me about Europe? And this is what he said.
Katie Lee, good evening. I think if you went back and listened to the messages I've sent you over the last few days, you probably would rethink your offer for me to co-host a pilot of this show with you, because I think I'm not very eloquent and I think I probably have a weird voice. But in all seriousness, I would love to give it a go. It kind of is terrifying and also really exciting, and there's a Dutch word for that, unlike in English, and it is spannend.
So embarrassing.
It's so sweet to listen to baby Dominic.
Yes, we're old now.
Oh, those were the days. Well, we have a great episode coming up reflecting on 5 years of the constant drama and weirdness, sometimes sadness, and even funniness that is life on this continent. And we're going to start with a very special edition of Good Week, Bad Week.
Good week, bad week.
So we thought we'd tweak the format a bit this week, shake things up for our birthday, and take a broader view than just 1 week. We are taking Good Week, Bad Week and turning it into Good 5 years, Bad 5 years. Each of us here today has chosen a candidate for who has had a good past 5 years and who has had a bad 5 years. Who wants to begin?
Let's begin with something happy, because mine is pretty depressing, so I prefer to give priority to somebody with a good news package.
Okay, I'll go first.
We have to ask you though. Katie won't let you start unless someone asks who's had a good 5 years. Katie's really, really strict on this. She always starts these recordings by being like, ask me who's had a good week.
So demanding.
So, Kat, who's had a good 5 years?
A good 5 years for solar panels is coming from me. Actually, this started in 2016. I saw this headline that Portugal had ran on renewable energy for 4 days straight, like the entire country.
I remember that.
Yeah. And at the time, I just really was like, whoa, we're so much further than I realized. And it made me really hopeful. And then over the past 5 years, whenever like the news is getting a bit grim, then I just go and look at like solar panel statistics to cheer myself up.
To each their own. Some people go for, you know, animal memes. Cats goes for articles about solar panels.
Anyway, little did I know in 2016, it has been an excellent 5 years for solar energy. Particularly in 2020, it was obviously a historically miserable year for the whole planet, but it was the first time that renewable energy, and in particular solar energy, became the cheapest source of energy in the world, like cheaper than the cheapest, most unsustainable fossil fuel.
Yay!
That is great.
Which is like massive, and also pretty amazing considering that we're not even calculating in the damage of climate change in the other fuel costs. And also just like the scale of how much renewable energy we're using has been really soaring in the past 5 years. Poland takes the cake. Poland has upped its solar energy 26 times since 2018.
Well done, Poland.
I have to tell you one thing, though. Every pole is being called 5 times a day by a company that's asking you to install solar panels on your roof. Even my six-year-old kid is like receiving those calls, so maybe that's why.
More importantly, why does your six-year-old have a phone?
No, he's got like a little phone that he only like uses to learn English and play sometimes, but yeah, they're calling this phone too.
I'm going
to
call his phone. I want to record that conversation.
That is amazing. Anyway, some other fun facts. Between May and August of this year, the EU generated 12% of all of its energy on solar, which, according to Carbon Brief Report, saved us 29 billion euros in gas imports.
Sweet. Especially at a time like this. That seems very good.
And something else that I read was that solar is then the cheapest form of electricity we've ever had because the cost of electricity has gone down so much.
Just a minute. If solar is so cheap, why are our energy bills so expensive?
Okay, so what I and many others started wondering during this energy crisis is how is the price of energy actually calculated? And it turns out that the EU does something called marginal pricing. And basically how that works is national electricity producers bid into the market. And then first, all of the cheapest energy is bought. So in this case, that'll be all the renewable energy. And then it slowly gets more and more expensive until the full demand is met. But the price is determined by the last most expensive source of energy, which means that the most expensive source is determining the price that all of the energy providers get.
That's really weird.
Yeah. And of course, that means at the moment we all have to pay whatever the price of gas is, even if we have invested in like energy companies that aren't actually using gas.
And that's why they're talking about now putting these windfall taxes on renewable energy companies as well as oil and gas companies, I guess, in some places.
Yeah. But there are some people pushing back on that, like countries like Spain and France and Portugal, who use much less gas per capita, are really arguing that it's time to change this pricing system. Because, of course, you could argue that like solar is being stimulated by making much more profit. But you could also argue that it's not really fair on consumers who've made this choice to invest in renewable energy companies who are not being rewarded for that choice to pay for less energy.
Well, it's funny you should say this because the doorbell is about to ring. Apologies, listeners, because the solar panel man is coming to deliver solar panels to my house this very morning while we're discussing this.
Wow.
So apologies for the interruption in advance, but does this mean I'm also going to suddenly become rich because I'm going to make the money of
an oil baron.
Of an oil baron from the solar panels on my roof.
No, you don't get guaranteed that same gas-determined price. So no marginal pricing for you. But what is cool is that a good chunk of your energy costs will be independent from all of this price regulation. And so you'll just only have to pay extra on whatever energy you need outside of your solar panel generation. Actually, one of the coolest things I think about solar is that the technology has become so cheap that a significant portion of Europeans can afford to put solar panels on their houses, which means that energy becomes way more decentralized and takes a lot more power away from these big energy companies.
Mm. Yeah, I'm just wondering what's the future for solar panel energy. Is it to become the main source of energy for Europe in the years to come?
I found it quite difficult to find solid statistics on like how much of solar energy is residential. So I couldn't really tell whether it would be possible that instead of having these like big fields where you have sort of monocrops of solar panels, how much of our energy could be covered by just covering all of these roofs with solar panels, whether that would be enough for us. There's some regulations coming in that every single new building would have to have solar panels on it as of 2029. But of course, there is some limitations because you need like silver and silicon, and those are obviously limited resources. Mm. But yeah, there's a huge push right now, especially with the energy crisis, to install as much as possible. And I guess we'll see how far we get.
Well, thank you for the very sunshiny good week, Kat.
Good 5 years for solar panels.
Who's had a bad 5 years, Katie?
I'm going to say it's been a bad 5 years for Western European naivety. When we started thinking about what has changed in Europe over the past 5 years, obviously Ukraine was the first thing that came to mind. There was, of course, already a conflict in Ukraine when we started this podcast, and I think a lot of Western Europeans tend to forget that. But the idea of a full-scale invasion of Ukraine by Russia, it was still hypothetical. It wasn't the horrible, horrible reality that it became in February this year. And I still think a lot about the conversations that we had in the days just before and after the invasion. And the conversation that still haunts me, Wojciech, is when you know, all of us, we were all worried about the troops massing on the border. But you admitted that you've been kind of self-censoring, like you felt like you couldn't keep saying, no, seriously, guys, an invasion is about to happen. You were worried about sounding like a quote unquote paranoid Pole. Do you remember that conversation?
Oh, yeah, very much. Yeah. The fact is that, you know, obviously this war that was sort of marginalized, you know, that started by the annexation of Crimea, I've witnessed a lot of signs of this war being a very real thing when I've reported in Ukraine before February of 2022. And I remember once I visited with my friend, we were reporting on something else, and then he showed me this exhibition in Sofiski Square where there are thousands and thousands of photos of soldiers that died between 2014 and 2022. So like, to me, this concentration of troops was something that really, you know, made me absolutely frightened. But also, I couldn't believe that was going to happen.
But it really, that conversation, it really rammed home to me what this conversation has been like between our governments, between governments in Western Europe and in Central and Eastern Europe. Because for years, politicians from Poland and Baltic countries have been shouting really loudly, Vladimir Putin has terrifying ambitions. He is expansionist. And the Eastern Europeans got told, oh, you know, I think Putin's just messing with us. And if we build up our trade with Russia, everything's going to stay peaceful and profitable. And no, you can't have thousands more NATO troops based in your country. Don't you think you're being a little bit paranoid? And I think the thing that's become painfully obvious is that the West didn't appreciate, really, the direct historical experience of Russian imperialism that these countries had, this direct experience of their land being taken away and many, many people being killed in the process. And over here to the West, I don't really think we were that interested in taking that historical experience seriously. I mean, it's not just about history, of course, it's also about geography, right? Like, it's a lot easier to feel safe from Russia if it is physically a lot further away. If you are Germany, for example.
Speaking of Germany, it feels like Angela Merkel really became the person to personify this Western European naivety.
Yeah, I mean, when she left power at the end of last year, it was mostly with a positive legacy, I would say. And just weeks after she's gone, Putin launches this full-scale invasion. And suddenly the policy that she had of engaging with him, even after Crimea got annexed from Ukraine in 2014, suddenly her policy of engaging with Russia didn't look so smart. If anything, it encouraged Putin to just think he could get away with stuff. And of course, one of the main things that now looks really short-sighted is the fact that Europe in general, and Germany in particular, got so addicted to Russian gas. By the time Merkel left office, Germany was dependent on Russia for more than half of its gas. And she was, of course, one of the biggest cheerleaders of the ill-fated Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline that was going to double the volumes of Russian gas to Germany.
But Merkel hasn't been really very apologetic about it, right?
She hasn't. I find that fascinating. She has been stunningly unself-critical about the whole thing, which is interesting because some other senior German politicians have, you know, held up their hands and said, we were wrong about Russia. Merkel has said that she doesn't have any regrets about her approach to Putin. She said that diplomacy was worth a try, even if it didn't work, and that Putin might have launched a full-scale attack earlier if he'd had fewer concessions. And she even defended buying all the gas. She said that it allowed Germany to push ahead with getting rid of nuclear and coal, which is a bit questionable, especially now that Russian gas has been cut off. Germany's actually had to reactivate some coal plants to fill the gap. But that is by the by. Anyway, yeah, to go back to the quote-unquote paranoid Central and Eastern Europeans and how ignored they were, you would hope that things have changed now, and that now when Eastern Europeans say, trust us, we know Putin better than you, he is a tyrant and he wants an empire, you would hope that governments further to the West will actually listen to them. You would hope so.
You would hope so.
Yeah, I wonder if that's true. I would hope that as well. But there's quite a lot of pressure at the moment from Western European governments for Ukraine to sit at a negotiating table with Putin. And yeah, I'm wondering if we've learned our lesson yet.
We're not always very good at learning lessons on this continent. Anyway, on that cheery note, Dominic, who's had a better 5 years?
I'm just going to stand up and shake my legs because 5 years into this podcast, I'm still recording from the floor of my bedroom and I've lost the feeling in my legs.
Yay.
Anyway, I want to argue that it's been a good 5 years for wolves in Europe.
Yay, wolves.
Yay, wolves. Cats loves wolves. This one's for you, Kat. There are a lot of pretty shitty stories about animals and biodiversity in Europe to talk about over the last 5 years. But according to the 2022 Wildlife Comeback Report, the wolves are doing really pretty well.
The Wildlife Comeback Report, hello.
Yeah, isn't that great? Yeah, I'm really picking the jolly bit of this report because there's also the fact that one in five mammals are endangered in Europe and one in eight birds are endangered. So
moving towards the wolves, moving towards the wolves.
Yes, okay, forget about that. Grey wolves in particular seem to have a big resurgence. Their population has increased massively since the 1970s when they were seriously endangered due to us pesky humans hunting them down and ruining their natural habitats. But yeah, this report from the organization Rewilding Europe suggests that grey wolves have increased in population size by around 1900% since the 1970s.
Whoa.
That's a lot of percent.
It is, isn't it?
Are they about to take over?
Just bad week for humans.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to that. But apparently you can now find grey wolves in almost every continental European country. Wolves have recolonized their old stomping grounds in places like the Apennine Mountains in Italy. There's also evidence that the number of wolf packs in the Alps has increased 25% in just 1 year.
Wow.
And according to the Rewilding Europe report, the grey wolves are having a great time in Central Europe in the past 20 years. Are you seeing them all over the place, Wojciech, in Warsaw?
What is your scientific definition of having a great time?
Fiesta.
Well, they're multiplying, let's put it like that.
One thing I saw is that there's a lot of advertisement on like an adventure you can have over a weekend where you just try to trace wolves.
Ooh.
One of my friends did it and he only saw like traces of wolves, not the actual wolves. So maybe they need to grow some more population for us to be able to actually see them. But the traces are there, so that's a good sign.
Let's go follow them for our 10th birthday.
Yeah.
Yes, please.
Wolf holiday. I can't wait.
So this does seem like good news for the wolves. I'm a little bit concerned about us humans, though. Is it good news for all of us?
Well, yes, I think it is. I know wolves are a bit scary. But if you remember, Katie, from our interview back in February 2018 with Max Rosberg from the European Wilderness Society, he actually pointed out that more humans in Europe are killed by cows than they are by wolves, like quite considerably.
How do the humans get killed by the cows?
Well, by being charged at, mainly people going for walks in mountains. I actually find cows really scary.
Me too, but I always tell myself it's not possible that they'll charge at me.
Yeah.
This is terrible news.
I think it is possible, sorry. In most part, wolves are actually not very interested in attacking humans. We can be friends.
They do like eating our farm animals, though, don't they?
They do, but there are ways to avoid your livestock being killed by wolves. And more people are going back to this old tradition of using livestock guard dogs. People are also installing electric fences. So here's the solar panel man. So sorry for the noise. And according to this Dutch wolf expert, Glenn Lelyveld, who was speaking to Euroactive, he said that wolves only account for 0.2% of damages paid for the loss of crops or livestock in Europe. So 0.2% is quite a small amount. And there are really good compensation schemes in place under EU law for farmers who are losing livestock. So we shouldn't overstate that problem, although I'm sure it is very annoying for some farmers.
Wait, Dominic, did you just suggest that we can be friends with wolves? Can I be a friend with a wolf?
Oh, it's funny you should ask this, because actually I did fall into a bit of a rabbit hole of watching videos of wolves that were friends with humans. And apparently it is possible. I really recommend everyone spend some time watching this compilation video that I watched. But I don't think that is totally normal. Don't try and make friends with a wolf if you come across one in the wild. That would be my advice. But anyway, I should probably explain why wolves are so important and why they are good for us. And it's because basically these predators are important to keep everything in check and balance. If you don't have predators, the whole ecosystem becomes imbalanced. And to give a more specific example of why wolves are necessary, if there aren't enough wolves in certain regions, then deer population often gets too big because the wolves aren't hunting and eating them. And we don't want the deer population to get too big because then the deer munch away on all the young trees that come out of the ground, damaging forest growth, which then obviously has this kind of negative butterfly effect on our whole ecosystem. We need forests to grow. Apparently, actually, sorry, we keep coming back to Poland, Wojciech, it's not just because you're here, but the growing wolf population in the Białowieża primeval forest in Poland, for example, has been really good for the forest, not just because wolves have been eating the deer, but because they've also been scaring away communities of deer and bison from certain areas and then allowing those areas to regenerate without being munched on too much.
Hooray.
I'm obviously simplifying it down to this one example, but the clear consensus is that the wolves are good and they're helping us and they're helping the ecosystem.
So we've got one final bad 5 years to hand out. Wojciech, who are you giving it to?
So I'm giving my bad 5 years to media freedom in Central and Eastern Europe. And this is because all the media freedom and the pluralism ratings have been on the downward spiral, really, with Hungary, Poland, Slovenia, Croatia and Serbia leading the charge. Basically, the reason for this is that Viktor Orban, whom I don't think I have to introduce to you, started this process of media acquisition back in 2010. And very unfortunately, it proved so successful for him and his friends that the other countries followed. And the last 5 years have been especially worrying. So it's a very premeditated method. And the way it works is that they take control of public media by putting their loyalists in a media council that's supposed to survey media independence and pluralism. And then subsequently, they usually put a politician in charge of state media. For example, Poland is a very hardcore case where the Law and Justice Party appointed their infamous spin doctor as the chairman of public TV channel. Not bad, huh? Then they turned public media into essentially propaganda tools. And it's followed by all the journalists who refuse to obey leaving public media and being replaced by the ruling party supporters who happen to be journalists. So all the countries I mentioned have witnessed mass exodus of great journalists from public media. And then what's happening is that they adopt some laws imposing restrictions on independent media outlets. Then they cut state funding for such outlets. And if those outlets are still trying to work as normal and criticize the ruling party, it's time for this party's oligarch friends to come into play and try to buy these outlets out. And this has been a real plague in Central and Eastern Europe in the last 5 years. For example, Orban's friends have managed to seize control over 500 media entities, not only in Hungary, but in the whole region. In Poland, state-owned oil company took over Polska Press, the biggest publisher of local newspapers and magazines, with a reach of over 17 million readers. Same thing happened in Serbia with Serbia Telecom, again a state-owned, tax-funded company that acquired independent media outlets and turned them into pro-government ones. So what follows all these actions is a media landscape where independent media is being marginalized and where ruling parties' propaganda is becoming absolutely unleashed. If you watched what the Hungarian state-owned media were saying in the beginning of the war in Ukraine, or if you listen to how Polish public TV or radio describes reality right now, well, it's becoming more and more North Korean. The generation of my parents who remember communist propaganda, they are sometimes shocked by what they hear. And if all the state media, including local newspapers, is state control, a lot of people, for example, those not very fluent in digital media consumption, would be only exposed to one viewpoint. And that has nothing to do with democracy. And we've seen what it can lead to, like, you know, given what Russians think about the war up till now.
You have kind of been a part of this journalist exodus from public media yourself, right?
Yeah, that's very true. And actually, of the team that I used to work with, nobody is still there. It doesn't like happen overnight. But when they come to you, they would appoint a new director, a new chairman, a new editor-in-chief. And just gradually, they make your life just impossible, like your work impossible to do the way you would like to do it. There is first some sign of censorship. They're not usually very like specific about what you can do and what you can't do. So instead of like doing, you know, journalism, you're staying at the corridor, chatting, you know, in a hushed voice with your friends, trying to figure out what you should and what you should not do. And then you're just fed up with this and you quit. And that's been the case for many, many outlets like Hungarian Index, like almost the entire team of the Polish public television and some newspapers. So it's basically just, you know, replacing old journals with like new ones who are more loyal to the party than to the ideals of journalism.
What can we, as like people who read the news, do to prevent these kinds of things happening in our countries?
Well, that's a very hard question. I think first thing we can do is vote better. If the party is meddling with media freedom, I think it's a sign of something really, really, really unsettling. Because, you know, obviously the party says that they're trying to limit media freedom is justified by the whatever reform they're trying to present. I don't think it's something we should fall for ever. The point of no return it comes pretty quickly. Let's imagine a grandma living in Poland that she doesn't really know how to install equipment to, let's say, watch satellite TV or digital TV, or she's not using internet. Then she's only exposed to public radio and television, and she's being served some really absurd nonsense there. And that's what those people believe. And it's not only grandmas, it's just a lot of people that really don't make the effort to look for alternative news sources. And I remember when the war broke out, the war in Ukraine, and we've seen the news of what Russians think about the war. One of my journalist friends said, like, look, like, this is a great example of the fact that journalism and the propaganda can be as powerful as weapons. And I think that's something very, very smart to say, because, like, for example, if you were in Poland and watched news of public television and the one remaining or two remaining independent channels, that's like two worlds.
It's just so amazing as well that this kind of media control seems to be stronger than family ties. So there are like so many families across borders that are falling out because of this. And yeah, it's not a very jolly thought, but I have to say, it also makes me wonder like what what I'm believing that is like absolutely not true. Is there something that I am thinking from news that's just like really, really not based in reality?
It's funny you say this because I've been thinking about it all the time, especially since the war broke out. It's like I'm constantly trying to like fact check everything and like look for data, look for news. Because like you're never known. It's just and the brainwashing, if you're like watching something like people in Poland, for example, like they usually watch one TV channel every day. Like if you watch something every day, you just lose the perspective. And I think it's really, really, really dangerous.
Plot twist, there are no wolves in Europe.
Are there any signs that anyone's worked out a way to kind of foil this system of taking over the media? Are there any bright spots anywhere?
I mean, because of the internet, we're seeing a lot of independent media outlets, you know, sort of like growing. A lot of those media is like Patreon funded or something. But then the problem is that just media literacy is not that high usually. It really requires some effort to find this podcast or find this little outlet. And people usually, they just rely on the thing that is, you know, like really easily accessible, which in these countries, especially like Hungary, Poland, Slovenia, it's state television. I think we just have to vote better and those governments have to go away and we have to like try to reverse this process and like instate people who really care about media pluralism into those media councils and like, you know, do this process all over again, which is very frustrating because we've been doing this after the communist regimes have fallen in 89-91. And now I think it's time to do it all over again.
5 years ago, this show was not particularly well put together. The sound quality was horrible. The editing was horrible. Nonetheless, we kept making it and people kept listening to it. And it blows my mind every single day that we are still doing this, that we have managed to turn the Europeans into something that makes episodes that explain complicated politics in an accessible way and episodes that tell these beautiful, intimate stories from across the continent.
Yeah, and the reason we're still doing this is because of you, extremely generous listeners who support the show so that we can cover our production costs. We made the Europeans for free for quite a long time, and there were lots of very late nights trying to juggle it with full-time jobs. Mm-hmm. And frankly, if our listeners hadn't stepped in to cover some of the costs so that Katie could at least cut back on other work, we would probably have stopped making the Europeans a long time ago.
You still seem to be working two full-time jobs, Dominic. That's a question for another day.
Yeah.
We also, without the Patreon supporters, definitely wouldn't have been able to start working with the two amazingly talented audio producers who are with us today. So thank you so, so much to those of you who support the show. And today we have a new batch of supporters to thank. Katzen Wojciech, would you like to do the honours and tell us who they are?
Okay, I'll start. Thank you very much, Flora Croy,
Brona Waldron,
Robert Jack,
Mirella Petre,
Niklas Knudsen,
Ines Abbas,
and Thomas Vetterli.
What if I butchered all the pronunciations?
Welcome to our world.
You can join these amazing people and keep us going for another 5 years or 50 years by Yay. Going to patreon.com/Europeans podcast. Even very small amounts can be helpful.
We are going to play this segment out with a jingle that was made for us by one of our Patreon supporters, the brilliantly talented singer-songwriter Mariska Martina.
There's probably quite a lot of listeners who have no idea that this jingle that you hear every week after this segment started life as one of my happy endings.
Yeah, it was a story from February last year about a very old shell in the Natural History Museum in Toulouse in southern France. And the researchers became very interested in a hole at the end of the shell.
And they decided to test it out and invited a French horn player to come and see if they could make any sound out of it. Excitingly, they could. Shall we hear some conch notes? That's how it sounds, yeah.
It's very beautiful.
So yes, that's a C natural, a D natural, and a C sharp.
If you say so.
Pretty amazing that this shell, once home to a sea snail, became a musical instrument, sat in a cave, undiscovered for many thousands of years, sat around again in a museum for nearly 100 years, and now is being played again, and now is being talked about on a podcast. What would these cavemen have thought about a podcast?
We should get a new jingle made out of it.
We definitely should. I think that's a great idea. Just imagine our delight when a couple of weeks later, a delightful piece of music dropped into our inbox made with those horrible conch sounds. They said it couldn't be done. Mariska performed a miracle. Should we play it?
Play it.
Today, we've got Katzen Wojciech with us, so we didn't really feel like we needed to invite someone else to join us for an interview. We've spoken to more than 200 people since we started making this podcast. Can you believe it? So we thought this week we can take a pause from adding to that list and instead go back and reflect on some of our favourite pod memories. And Katie has spent quite a bit of time diving into our back catalogue with, I'm sure, some inevitable cringe, but I hope also some pride.
Yeah, it has been quite cringy, but really, really nice listening back to the archives. And one of the cool things is that it reminded me of all of the stuff that we were interested in 5 years ago. For example, can you remember that we were actually quite excited about this idea that eating insects was about to become really mainstream in Europe? Because quite a few governments were legalizing it at the time.
I do remember going to a supermarket opening 5 years ago and there were all of these like maggot chicken nuggets that really just tasted just like McDonald's.
I don't know why it hasn't taken off yet, but it hasn't. We've also seen governments come and governments go, which has given us plenty to talk about over the years. And I wanted to play a little tribute to the many, many elections that we have covered during the last half decade of this podcast. Spain has got a government. Northern Ireland has got a government.
Belgium still doesn't have a government.
In 5 years of podcasts, you probably have seen plenty of Italian prime ministers coming and going.
I've been cheated by you since I don't know where.
It's been a bad week for the prime ministers of both Slovenia and Slovakia. They both resigned within hours of each other last week.
Viktor Orban has won re-election in Hungary.
Let's say that Bosnia for now has three main presidents at the state level.
That's a sea change in Irish politics. It's never happened before.
That's the other thing. It's people have brought that up, that it's not a fair election because there's no chance to campaign. Right now in Poland, the limit on public gatherings is 2 people. Mamma mia,
here I go again. The Sweden Democrats are now the second biggest party in Sweden with about 20% of the vote.
You say that the right bloc has won, but actually, we shouldn't forget that the Social Democrats were the biggest party by like quite a way again.
What happened here? Because I feel like I went on holiday for a week and left you in charge of Europe. And next thing I know, there are new governments in Spain and Italy and reports that a bunch of animals have escaped from a German zoo. Like, what happened?
Very dramatic.
RIP to all the governments who didn't make it.
We really could have made this podcast just about European elections, frankly.
Yeah, we could have done plenty of material. But yeah, elections aside, there are certain themes that we've kept coming back to over the years. I guess because they're fundamentally important things that shape people's lives in Europe. And we wanted to celebrate some of the excellent guests who have helped us to explore these themes.
Yes, so today's first theme is languages, which have come up quite a lot in the show. We've talked about the peculiar form of English that's grown up among people in Brussels, speaking English as a second language. It's sometimes referred to as EU speak or Euro English. We also discussed the subtle and frankly tricky art of subtitling television series in the era of all these streaming services. And in one of our earliest episodes, Katie spoke to Franz Kubitschek, who at the time was regularly the voice of Donald Trump on German television. The interview was about how to translate Trump's shithole countries statement, but also more broadly about what it's like to have to be the voice of someone so objectionable in your language.
I have heard many times it can't be that difficult to interpret Donald Trump because his terminology is rather basic, and that's absolutely true. He doesn't really use quite a sophisticated language, but he can really get you off guard. It's that cringe-worthiness, you know? Cringing is not something you can really do if you're doing live interpreting. It always gets to you, like, did he really just say that? Okay, I have to say that. How can I say it? And those are all processes that are usually making interpreting much more difficult. And that horrible personality and the horrid things he's saying, they affect you as a private person as well, even though you have to be there as an interpreter and it's not about your private opinion on him. It still gets to you. It's quite a struggle. It's quite an internal struggle because on the one hand, you think, oh God, what an idiot. I really hate this man. And on the other hand, you have to be that man and say what he just said without actually blinking.
Oh, what a tough position to be in.
Yeah, quite a job.
Anyway, people come to this show to avoid Trump, or at least they did. When we started this, he was still president, so let's move on.
That's true. It was just a really fun interview, though. Yeah, but I love that this podcast is unapologetically nerdy about languages. Another thing that we've become quite nerdy about is better understanding how the Brussels bubble works. We are not of the bubble ourselves. None of the people who make this podcast live in Brussels. But we did start this podcast with the vague knowledge that A, EU institutions have serious power over our lives, and B, we knew shamefully little about how these institutions actually operate. So we've been on a bit of a journey to get to grips with these institutions, and it's been surprisingly fun. There was the time that Katz kidnapped the show so that she could explain to us how the EU ban on single plastics got passed.
It's Katz. I'm kidnapping the show this week. Sorry, Katie and Dominic. Sorry, listeners. But I had a really important question I wanted the answer to. And that question is, how the hell do you make an EU law? Apparently, I have to start out by downloading an app.
Game begin.
We have also visited the belly of the beast itself. Over the years, some very kind Brussels insiders have taken us under their wing, explained stuff to us, and given us some very unofficial tours of EU institutions. And we've learned a lot. Here is our tour of the European Commission with Tom Moylan. He was working there as a speechwriter at the time.
My girlfriend, actually, was trained as an interpreter. One of the abiding memories she has of being an interpreter is the smell in these cabins. because you essentially have two people in a very enclosed space working very hard under high pressure, which means it's just a sweatbox.
I feel like we've come quite far in figuring out actually how the Brussels bubble works. We even got to host an event in the European Parliament a few weeks ago.
I have to say, it's one of my proudest learning points of this show that I actually know what all the different councils of the EU are.
Have we become insiders? Are we Brussels bubbles insiders now?
I think maybe we're less outsiders than we were, but we're definitely not outside. Maybe we're like sitting on the smoking terrace.
Oh, cool.
Cigarettes are a single-use plastic, Dominic.
Don't smoke, everyone. Anyway, we've also spent a lot of time discussing some of the most striking pieces of policy that have cropped up in the past 5 years in Europe. We've discussed drug policy in Portugal, lots of innovative policies in Spain lately. And I really enjoyed speaking to Pasi Salberg, an ex-school teacher from Finland, now education professor, who talked to us about what makes Finland's education system different.
Something that's really striking in Finland is that you have to have a master's degree to become a teacher. How do you think that requiring teachers to be really highly trained in this way changes the way that they're seen in society?
It's a really good question, because often people say that you don't need a master's degree to teach in a kindergarten or primary school. And that may be true, that you don't need to get the 5 years or 6 years of academic education for that. But what will not happen if you have lower requirements for teacher credential than master's degree is that often young people look for more ambitious and challenging academic programs, and they want to do some real stuff, like what the lawyers and doctors and engineers and architects do. We understood that early on in Finland, if we want to have the teaching profession as competitive and attractive for young people as medicine or law or any of those other things, the basic starting point is to make sure that the students study the same similar degrees at the same level of academic requirements.
I am amazed at how often people bring that episode up to me. People talk to me about that episode all the time.
What do they say?
Just like, this is really sensible. Teachers should be really super well respected in society, and their pay should reflect that. Like, they should get paid the same amount as like bankers because of how important their job is.
I cannot agree more. I was borderline crying after I listened to this episode.
Because of how different it is for your kids?
Yeah, because of how underpaid teachers are in Poland and everywhere around. Basically, what we say about the educational system is that, like, the people who couldn't find work somewhere else, they would go to teach because, you know, they weren't qualified enough to work at, you know, companies.
There's this expression in English, those who can't teach, which is a horrible expression.
It's horrible. And still, like, there's lots of absolutely brilliant people teaching. It's very important that I mentioned that, but they're doing this mostly for the idea of, you know, education, not for money, which is a shame.
We need to take a leaf out of Finland's book.
On the less positive side, though, you know, I think you could describe us as a podcast that loves Europe, but it's not that we're uncritical. And something that's come up a lot is immigration policy when it comes to the treatment of arriving refugees. And that's happening pretty much across the continent, whether it's in Greece or the Mediterranean. I got to see up close how awful it got when the migrants got used as a political bargaining chip by the government of Belarus towards the end of last year. It's Fortress Europe.
We actually made an episode about the EU's border agency, Frontex.
As they enter Greek waters, a big, imposing ship approaches, casting a huge shadow over the dinghy. This ship is run by the Romanian Coast Guard. You can see the flag on the side.
And what is a Romanian ship doing so far from home?
It's there on behalf of Frontex, an organization you might have heard of.
Since we made that episode late last year, the bad headlines have not stopped racking up for Frontex. They actually acknowledged, quote, serious misbehavior when it came to illegal pushbacks of migrants. Although they said it's a thing of the past. We'll see. We've also spent a lot of time thinking and talking about identity. Actually, one of the reasons why we wanted to start this podcast was to discuss whether the idea of European identity was even a thing. And I think we conclude that the fact that this podcast is still in existence 5 years later suggests that it is a thing, at least for some people. One area of discussion around identity that we have regularly discussed is the ongoing fight for LGBTQ plus rights in Europe, something that is close to my heart and to my own life. Here is Remco Jitzak Koremans talking about a proposed Dutch law that will have a huge impact on rainbow families.
Multi-parent families exist, okay? So there can be all sorts of different setups. There can be up to three or four parents. So sometimes you've got a gay couple co-parenting with a single woman. Other times there's a lesbian couple co-parenting with a single man or even with another gay couple. Under the new law, preconception, so even before they try to get pregnant, effectively, they go to court and then a special advocate for the kid will be assigned by the court as well, arguing the interests of the kids. And then the judge or the chamber will actually issue a verdict so that the parents will be legal parents and have custody at the moment the children are born.
It's worth noting that this law has still not made its way to Dutch Parliament. They're taking their time on that one.
Come on. When it comes to identity, we often also discuss questions around race and racism and the experiences of non-white Europeans. And one interview that I loved was with the French blogger Grace Lee about why Asians are so invisible in French culture.
I think it's wrong to think that East Asian people are invisible because they're discreet or because they don't like to work in arts or culture and they prefer restaurants. I think there's nothing genetic about being visible. This is really linked to racism and history and how the perception of East Asians in Europe hasn't changed. We're still seen as, you know, hardworking restaurant owners. Maybe now we have nail salons, but we can never be just, you know, universal.
We also grow cannabis, Klaas. You forgot that one.
Oh, yes.
It is such a good interview. Check it out if you haven't already. And a related thing that we've talked about a lot, and I want to flag it up because it is, again, one of my favourite interviews, is Europe's history, and in particular, the way that Europe wrestles with its colonial history or ignores it. But I think probably the interview that I still think about the most a couple of years later was this one, which I recorded in Nairobi with the Kenyan cartoonist and commentator, Patrick Gathara.
You wrote recently about this concept, Eurafrica.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm someone who is interested in European history. I never heard of this expression. Right. Why do you think so many Europeans don't know about this part of our history?
Well, it's not just Europeans, to be quite honest. And the fact is, lots of the colonial history is buried both for the colonizers and the colonized. There has been, I think, on both ends, an attempt to reshape history to try and pick out particular themes that legitimize the systems that exist. In the case of Europe, this idea that was pushed for a very long time that colonialism was essentially a benevolent thing. You know, it brought something called development, it brought modern medicine, you know, gave us roads and cars, etc. On the other side, you've got the people who got independence, who are trying to legitimize themselves. And to be quite honest, lots of them went out in the period after independence, behaved very much like the colonials they'd kicked out. And they don't want that continuity to be seen. So they also have an inbuilt incentive, in essence, to try and massage history, to tell the story in a particular way. So that's how we end up, all of us, not really knowing what happened.
And finally, I didn't think we could do a retrospective episode without touching on our absolutely favourite thing to discuss, food. Food has come up quite regularly on this podcast, and one of my all-time favourite conversations was about my all-time favourite food, that rubbery Cypriot cheese, halloumi.
That I've been living on for the last 3 days.
Yeah, I was going to ask.
So that's why you went to Cyprus.
Oh, so jealous.
Does it taste different there?
It's served in so many different ways and it's just delightful, I have to say. I've had halloumi in pita, I had halloumi in pastry, in a bun.
Oh.
Yeah, it's just a halloumi El Dorado.
Well, I'm incredibly jealous. The discussion we had on this podcast a while back about halloumi was about how the EU was giving halloumi this protected designation of origin status, where you can only sell a specific food if it is proven to have been made in the region that it was traditionally made in. And the move was being seen as a form of cheese diplomacy, because the EU was giving this status to cheesemakers on the Greek side as well as on the Turkish side of the island. We spoke to Natalie Lamprou about Cyprus's history and Cypriot identity, and we just couldn't help but keep bringing it back to halloumi, or helim as it's called amongst Turkish Cypriots.
Sorry to take things back to a stupid cheese question again.
Halloumi is never stupid. Go.
But is it true to say, I mean, the EU is pitching this as a food stuff that genuinely crosses the political divide and is universally enjoyed as a food? Do Turkish Cypriots and Greek Cypriots enjoy halloumi in the same way? Do they cook it in the same way?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's actually this Instagrammer, Melise. She's a Turkish Cypriot and she does food blogging. Her feed is full of halloumi, and that kind of also made me realize, like, it's not just us, like, they love it as well. They eat it with watermelon in the summer, which is how we eat it. It's like the best summer lunch to have when it's 40 degrees Celsius outside. We grill it. They also age it, which is not a version of the cheese that's exported to the West, although it's very delicious, and I highly recommend you try it if you ever get the opportunity.
One of my favorite episodes we made was with Sarah, who told us the history of Albania transitioning to capitalist democracy through this amazing savory porridge-like dish, trahana. Sarah watched her grandparents eat trahana all the time, but for some reason, she wasn't allowed to eat it. And when her grandmother passed away, while she was grieving, she decided to cook it and taste it for the first time with her mum. Along the way, she took us on this amazing journey about how she and her mother and her grandmother all grew up in these really different versions of Albania because of how quickly politics changed. And as a result, had a very deep and distinctive relationship with this dish. And it also just sounded really delicious.
Mm. One of my first memories is of my grandmother making trahana in her two-bedroom apartment where my mother and uncle grew up. And you would open the door and the whiff, this fermentation whiff, would hit you in the face. And I would know, aha, it's trahana time. You'd have this sunlight, this orangey tints from the sun and from the trahana, which is orange. So everything just felt orange and acidic and fermented.
Well, that seems like a warm and tasty place to round up this nice journey back in time. Any final words from anyone, or any hopes for the future of this podcast baby?
I don't think technically it's a baby anymore. It's a toddler. And trust me, I've got kids, so I know better.
They're almost in school.
They are in school. Is it a toddler still?
I do have something a bit soppy, I want to say. People often say to me, like, I like listening to your podcast because it sounds like you are actually genuinely friends. And sometimes I can't believe that we are still friends because it's quite stressful making a podcast. But against all odds, we are still friends. And I talk to you, Dominic, more than anyone else in my life, probably more than my husband. And I still love talking to you. I still look forward to it every week. So I want to say a special tribute to my friend Dominic Kramer for being my pal all these years.
No.
And sticking by me.
That's so sweet and soppy. Thank you, Katie. I also was thinking the other day after we had these 3 days together in Brussels that I like you more and more, which is quite amazing considering we are working together in quite like a stressful environment and doing millions of other things at the same time. So
sorry,
I'm really
wait,
glad you...
How did you feel about me at the beginning?
Oh, you don't want to know.
I feel like one of these like grown-up children at their parents' 50th anniversary. It's like, my parents love each other. Wojciech, look at our parents.
And we love you too, our podcast children, Katz and Wojciech. I mean, you have come into our lives more recently. Dominic and I have been friends for, I think, 15 years now. Disturbing.
Wow.
But you two have also become really good friends and I love working with you. So thank you for being a delight.
Yes, thank you both. I really think we wouldn't still be doing this podcast if you guys hadn't joined the team. You really have elevated this whole show and brought so much to our team. I'm learning so much from your incredibly wise brains. So thank you both too.
What can we say to end this episode apart from a massive thank you to everyone who has spoken to us over the last 5 years and given up their free time to explain often very complicated things to us in a way that makes Europe feel a little bit closer. We also want to say thank you to those of you who have made music for us, Jim and Mariska, and to anyone who has ever taken the time to send us a message to suggest a story or to point out when we've screwed things up and could have done things a bit better or said nice things about us.
Thank you so much to everyone who's decided to spend time listening to this podcast, and especially to our wonderful Patreon supporters. This is making it sound like it's our final episode ever, which it isn't.
We are still going to be in your podcast feed next week and the week after that and the week after that until we all die. That's a grim way to end this episode, but here we are.
Thank you also to our friends at Are We Europe, at Allianz Foundation, at the European Cultural Foundation. It's been great working with you all over the past few years.
After the credits, I thought we could finish the show as we did in the early days with a couple of European tongue twisters from the archive. So we will leave you with those. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. See you next week.
Bye.
Ciao.
Ciao, ciao.
Rotkraut bleibt Rotkraut und Brautkleid bleibt Brautkleid.
What does it mean?
Red cabbage.
Kind of thing. And the other one is like a dress for marriage.
Okay, wedding dresses and red cabbages. Lovely.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Sju sjösjuka sjömän sköttes av sju sköna sjuksköterskor.
One is a very short one, which sounds like I'm yodeling, which is litiludilo, yodiludilidilo.
Wow!
It means, is that light on? Yes, that light is on. And the other one is slightly less PC. It is van Herendicken, Eisendicken, Enke, Dicke, Vanant, Vanant, Eisendicken, Herendicken, Zulein, Dicke, Viserendicken, Eisendicken, Nimi, Dicke, Vanant. Which means, if your fat kid calls our fat kid fat one more time, then our fat kid will call your fat kid fat until your fat kid stops calling our kid fat.